funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What does it take for an outsider to truly understand a new and alien culture, and how does such an experience change one's identity? When Mitch Moxley was offered a job with the English-language newspaper China Daily, he figured it couldn't hurt the stagnant social life and freelance journalism career he had in Toronto at the time. So he packed up and moved to Beijing, where he could chart the course of a rapidly developing nation preparing for the global spotlight of the Olympic Games, and where he would counterintuitively find himself despite never entirely fitting in. Journalist Mitch Moxley writes for publications including The Atlantic, The New York Times, and The Globe and Mail. His new book is called Apologies to My Censor, The High and Low Adventures of a Foreigner in China. Mitch, welcome to Think.
Hey, Chris. Thanks for having me.
So you had done a lot of traveling in Asia, but you write that you had never really imagined yourself living in China. Explain how the China Daily job came to your attention and why they were looking to add writers from abroad.
Right, yeah. So I'd been in Japan and elsewhere in Southeast Asia before that, and China had never really been on my radar as a place to move. I was, you know, interested in its development just like anybody else who pays attention to the news, but, you know, it wasn't a place that I thought I'd ever end up. I'd been living in Toronto and working as a freelance writer, and I was just sort of scouring the web for jobs when one day I found an advertisement for jobs for, you know, foreigners to come to China. And so I applied on a whim and then did an editing test and a quick interview, and then next thing I knew I was on a plane to Beijing with a one-year contract. And at that time, this was just over a year before the Olympics, and the government decided they were going to invest in expanding China Daily. So they had redesigned the paper and expanded it and hired a couple dozen, we were called foreign experts, that was the visa that we had. So people from, you know, the States and Canada and Australia and other English-speaking countries were coming there to sort of fill these gaps.
And there were people who warned you that working there would not be a good experience because the paper functioned as what you discovered Lonely Planet called the Chinese government's favorite English-language mouthpiece. That's a quote.
Right. Yeah, I had a friend whose father worked at Xinhua, which is the state newswire, and China. It provides a lot of content for China Daily. And so in the application process, I had emailed him and just asked him a few questions. And he warned me that it'd be different from the experiences that I'd had previously in Canada. And another American editor who was working at China Daily at the time, he also told me not to expect a North American newspaper. News at China Daily was fairly strictly controlled by the government, which was, you know, the ultimate owner of the paper.
Who's the audience for the China Daily?
The audience for the China, the main audience is English-speaking Chinese Chinese who speak English who want to practice their English. It also has, you know, a small kind of foreign audience in Beijing. But actually now, I mean, they've expanded so much that you can get the English language edition on the streets of New York City. So they've definitely expanded their audience. But, yeah, the main audience are Chinese people who speak English and want to practice it.
I was fascinated that, you go into a job like that, you recognize that censorship will be something you come up against. Self-censorship by the journalists was so strong that the crackdowns by the government were almost unnecessary.
Yeah, absolutely. As I mentioned in the book, the most prevalent form of censorship was self-censorship. The reporters and editors just knew what could and couldn't go into the paper. So some of the more obvious things like the Tiananmen Square massacre in 1989 and political stories relating to Taiwan and Tibet, they were just entirely off limits. Like nobody was going to pitch a story based on those three topics. There weren't going to be any stories that were heavily critical of the government. Anything that sort of touched on anything remotely sensitive, for example, relations between China and the States, those stories would be taken to a senior editor who would look at it, and it would kind of keep going up to whoever was at the top that determined which stories went in. But, you know, most of the time it just didn't need to go there because, the reporters in the newsroom knew what was off limits.
And at one point, there was this edict that, okay, China Daily will not cover. And it's like Angela Merkel no longer exists because she met with the leaders of Tibet. Is that it?
Yeah. So we had a meeting. I was in the business section. Mm-hmm. And we had a meeting one day, and they printed off schedules for the top stories that we'd be covering in the next day's paper. And in the meeting, the business editor said the story about something to do with the German economy, we wouldn't be writing that story because Merkel had recently met with the Dalai Lama. And so she said we indefinitely wouldn't be covering Germany in the China Daily. So Germany, I think, was the third largest economy at that time in the world, and it had simply sort of disappeared off China Daily's radar for the time being.
So what kind of deal did the paper offer you? What was your contract to work there for a year?
So I was on a one-year contract. The pay was fairly good by Beijing standards. It sort of amounted to about 24,000 U.S. a year. Which is a very comfortable living in China. And we had apartments provided for us. It was sort of like a dorm room type setup. We had the apartments were on the same campus as the China Daily newsroom. And the foreign editors lived on a series of about three floors in this building. And then, we'd walk to work 5 minutes away. Like I said, it was a one-year contract. I was in the business section. And I had been told that I'd be I was being hired as a writer because I had some experience as a business reporter before that. But when I arrived there, I found that they mostly wanted me to just edit. And this was a huge disappointment for me because it meant that I had to be working from 2 in the afternoon till about 11 at night. And I wanted to be out exploring Beijing and getting a taste of the nightlife and everything. But instead, I was toiling away in the China Daily office. So it was a few months before I actually got my first reporting assignment.
And what was the breakdown on the staff between Chinese nationals and expat journalists?
At that time, there were probably only 20 to 30, maybe about 30 expat journalists at the whole paper, and then a couple hundred Chinese. So it was by far, the staff was mostly Chinese. And we were sort of part of an experiment to introduce foreign writers at the paper. Previous to that, the foreigners of the paper had just been copy editors. So I was part of the first sort of wave of foreign journalists hired to actually contribute stories to the paper. Mm-hmm. And I was the first ever in the business section, which was actually a little bit complicated because I quickly found that the editors weren't super keen on having foreigners writing for the business section.
And it's, I suppose, not surprising that the Chinese employees sort of resented the expatriates because you guys were making a lot more money. You had housing provided for you. Essentially, you got a sweeter deal.
Yeah, absolutely. And I can totally sympathize with them. The other thing is that, especially, when I started writing, is the editors just didn't know what to do with us, We would kind of pitch stories that we thought might, appeal to a foreign audience or something that you might want to pitch to a foreign newspaper. And it's not really how it worked there. Like, very rarely were reporters pitching stories to the editors. The news kind of came top down. When I started, I would be given these sort of fluff pieces to go and report maybe once a week or once every 2 weeks. And the rest of the time, I just kind of sat at my desk, twiddling my thumbs, trying to think up things to do. And so, obviously for the Chinese reporters who are really working hard to put out the paper, they see this person who just showed up with a salary that's probably three times theirs and a nicer apartment and not doing any work. And, you could definitely sort of sense the resentment in some people. It wasn't universal by any means. But, I can definitely sympathize with that sentiment.
So the paper publishes entirely in English, but of course, if you are reporting, you're in a foreign country, people there are speaking Chinese, you arrived with virtually no language skills. Did that worry you at the outset?
It didn't worry me at the outset because when I first moved there, I thought I was only going to stay for 16 months maybe. I was going to, work out my contract and then stick around for the Olympics and then take off. At China Daily, when I actually did report for the paper, if I needed a translator, they would just send a reporter with me. And even at that time, a lot of the foreign journalists also didn't really speak Chinese. Mm-hmm. I think now, those days are kind of gone. Right now, there's so many good reporters there, and they speak great Chinese. And I think the days of the expat journalist who doesn't speak Chinese are over. But I wasn't really concerned about it at the time because even when I did my own freelance assignments, I could find a translator online quite easily, who would come with me and translate for the interviews. So it wasn't a big concern for me when I first got there.
I was interested to read that you, when you first got there, you were taking some language lessons, but at first you literally were sort of pointing and grunting and trying to make yourself known if you were out on the street. And you found that body language didn't translate. Is that a matter of culture, that a gesture in North America means something very different than it might mean in China?
I think it's more that, if you're a foreigner and you go into a restaurant and you don't speak Chinese and they don't speak English, everybody's just a little bit intimidated of one another. It's a little bit awkward, and you can, sit there and try to explain what you want, but it just all sort of gets lost. And I mentioned this one time in the book where I went for lunch, and I was by myself. And, in China, you eat in groups. You rarely go out by yourself, and if you do, it's just sort of to a noodle shop. And so I just looked at the menu and looked for something that I thought was a reasonable price for a, a lunchtime meal. And I ended up getting this, like, massive bowl full of broth and chicken that could have served about 6 or 7 people. But yeah, I mean, the body language just didn't really work for me.
And then much later, as you did finally develop the ability to communicate verbally, you write about a sort of shift in your personality to what you call your Chinese identity. Will you talk about that?
Yeah, sure. I think this is pretty common for most foreigners who come to China and stay for a long time. I had a friend once who spoke fluent Chinese, and as I was, in the process of trying to learn it, she told me that once you speak Chinese, it's like seeing in color. And I mean, that's incredibly apt comparison, because as soon as you learn the language, just the whole world kind of opens up. Chinese people will open up to you a lot more. They're sort of the behavior towards you changes, and then for me, it also meant that the language sort of became this mask that you could hide behind, and you sort of develop just a little bit of a different personality, and it sort of at first happens subtly, but later on it kind of happens a bit more profoundly, where you definitely recognize that you're developing a sort of different identity over there in your interactions with Chinese people. And I think, for a lot of people, going overseas anywhere really is a chance to reinvent yourself. And, for me, definitely that was the case in China, especially as my language improved.
Well, I think that's so fascinating, and it made me think really about anybody living as a foreigner anywhere in the world and the ways in which their identity is suddenly defined to such a great extent by how different they are from the locals.
Absolutely, and I mean, definitely. You're in China, especially as a foreigner, you always stand out, and people are always curious about you, and you're always just a little bit different. But at the same time, you're anonymous. You can walk through and you're not part of the local community, so there's a degree of anonymity with that. And I think just living in China becomes so much a part of people's identity that that's one of the reasons that people like me stay there for so long, so much longer than they intended.
Hmm. Were there times when you wished you could blend in and you just realized that was a lost cause?
Yeah, I mean, when I went reporting to some more remote areas in China, you walk down the street and every head turns to you, especially these kind of smaller communities where very few foreigners go. And, as a reporter, it just makes it really hard to get information from people. Those are definitely times where you wish you could just sort of blend in and have people open up to you a bit more. But it's impossible when you're the only foreigner who's been to this town in months.
My guest is journalist Mitch Moxley. He writes for publications including The New York Times, The Globe and Mail, and The Atlantic. His new book is called Apologies to My Censor, The High and Low Adventures of a Foreigner in China. We'll talk more after this break, and we will invite you now to call in with any questions or comments. The telephone number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to personal finance. Fall registration opens on August 6th. catalogs can be requested at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with journalist Mitch Moxley, whose new book is called Apologies to My Censor, The High and Low Adventures of a Foreigner in China. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or by emailing think@kera.org. So, Mitch, you write about a number of times where you began to understand the concept of face in China and this sort of idea of personal dignity and the ways that this can be offended and the ways that embarrassment is sort of a bigger deal there than it would be in a place like Canada or the U.S.
Yeah, I mean, face is absolutely crucially important in, you know, interpersonal relationships in China, and I learned that the hard way a couple of times. The first time I really kind of learned about the concept of face was during group Chinese classes at China Daily. Mm-hmm. I had been struggling in my one-on-one classes with my teacher, whose name is Miss Song, and I had paid her to prepare these weekly tests for me. And during the next group class at China Daily, I noticed that she was distributing the tests that I had paid for. And I mean, it was not a big deal, and I wasn't angry, but I thought I'd sort of call her on it. And, you know, I said, I wouldn't be paying for you to make these tests if I knew you were going to distribute it to other people, even though I was paying her something like $4 to make the tests. And she just got incredibly embarrassed, and, you know, her face went red, and she just sort of shut down. And I noticed that this was happening, and I told her I was sorry, and it wasn't a big deal. And then afterwards, a friend of mine who had been in China a bit longer sort of pulled me aside and says, like, you need to be more aware of doing things like that. It's a face thing. And I didn't, you know, really understand what he meant. And then she later emailed me telling me, you know, just how upset I had made her. And, yeah, that was the first sort of introduction of the concept of face to me. And, I mean, it definitely wasn't a pleasant experience, but I was much more careful after that.
Yeah, it's just really remarkable the ways that different cultures interpret things that just don't seem like a big deal to us. And there are things I'm sure that would be a big deal to Americans that Chinese people don't think are an issue. And you have to, I suppose, unlatch from what seems reasonable to you and recognize that your sense of that is indeed shaped by your culture and not by some you know, universal human norm.
Yeah, exactly. You know, in this situation, if it was a, you know, a friend in the States or something, it would just be an opportunity for a little bit of banter and a bit of a joke. But I mean, she was really, really embarrassed by it, and you know, I felt terrible about it as well. You don't want to make somebody feel like that. And in China, you know, over the course of the years that I lived there, you definitely pick up on these cultural differences and learn to sort of adapt.
So there were a couple of different types of expatriate journalists that you encountered while you were working at China Daily. Can you talk a little bit about them?
Sure. There were some younger journalists like myself who you know, were hired and then wanted to come there to sort of experience the build-up to the Olympics. These people would have been from their sort of late 20s through their 30s. And then there was another group of older, they were all men, and a lot of them had sort of been drifting around Asia for, you know, in some cases a couple decades, working at these English language newspapers like China Daily. And in many ways, these were sort of the classic expat types. In the book, I reference a quote in The Rum Diary, the Hunter S. Thompson book. Mm-hmm. And I mean, these guys really fit the bill. Like, they were, you know, heavy drinkers, you know, went out till 4, 5, 6 in the morning, drinking and smoking most nights of the week, and then would show up, you know, at work hungover the next day. And they always, you know, they worked hard and they did their job. But yeah, they had sort of been caught in this artificial reality that is the sort of expat universe over there. And, you know, many of them were probably never going to get out. It just had become their reality.
Did you talk a lot to your colleagues from other democratic countries about how, especially the ones who had quite a long tenure there at China Daily, how they finally made peace with the fact that this was not journalism in any sense of the word as it would be interpreted in Canada or the U.S. or most of Europe?
Yeah, this was a pretty frequent topic of conversation among the expats there, you know, about what role we really should play at China Daily and, you know, what it said about us working at China Daily. Was it, you know, ethical? Especially for the younger people who had been, you know, I just was working in a newspaper in Canada a couple years before that, and I was not long out of journalism school, where we actually had to take classes in ethics. And then you come to a paper where, you know, it's just a totally different work environment. It's, you know, owned by the communist government of China. Everything's top down, and, you know, like I was talking about before, like just anything politically sensitive just doesn't make it in the paper. And so we would have these debates about whether, you know, we actually could change the paper, whether we should even be trying, whether this was journalism or if it was just PR. And I don't think, you know, none of us really answered any of those questions except to ourselves, I suppose. And but I think for some of these guys that had been there for a long time, they just didn't care anymore. I think those conversations were kind of long over, and they just accepted it for what it was. Which was, you know, a job with a decent paycheck in an interesting place. And that's I sort of had that transition as well. When I first got there, I was really frustrated, especially when I was trying to report stories. Some of my stories I would report, and then they would just never go to print, and nobody would ever really explain to me why. Other ones would be, you know, they'd take out anything sort of remotely sensitive from the story. And it was frustrating, and I'd kind of, you know, hit my head against the wall. But as time went on, you realize, like, you're not going to win this battle. And I sort of just accepted the job as being, you know, a really interesting experience. And it was. I mean, working inside the state media in China in 2007, 2008 was just a really incredible experience. And, you know, like I said, we were pretty well paid, and it was really comfortable, and I met some really interesting people. And so once I sort of accepted it for what it was, I actually, you know, really had a great experience at China Daily.
Did that experience help you to understand how some sort of upwardly mobile middle-class Chinese do not seem to be clamoring for full rights and democracy the way we might imagine that they would?
I think just, you know, being in China over those years helped for me to understand, you know, what that sort of that mentality that you're talking about. And you're absolutely right. Like, middle-class Chinese are not calling for a Western style of democracy. And I mean, working at China Daily, it was definitely a sort of crash course in kind of learning this the mentality of the new China. You know, we were reading about it every day.
What did you have to do in order to get pretty unfettered access to information from the outside world? What were the workarounds necessary?
So back then, and still today, I think actually Facebook might actually be accessible now. But back then, Facebook was blocked, Twitter was blocked, YouTube, and sometimes Google. You'd have problems with Google, and especially when any type of kind of incident arose, like the riots in Tibet in 2008, all those websites would be blocked, and any kind of news source from the area would be blocked as well. And so the main workaround then was these things called proxy servers, and they would be online, and you'd just go to the proxy site and then insert the website that you wanted to see, and then you'd be able to see it. It would load quite slow, but you'd eventually be able to access it. And then later on, as time went on, everybody would buy these things called VPNs, and VPNs allowed you to sort of access anything that was blocked. And again, it would be quite a bit slower than normal, but you know, we were able to sort of get information we needed.
When you say everybody would buy these, are these solutions that would be available to any Chinese citizen who had the means to own a computer?
Yeah, I mean, when I say I'm talking mostly about the foreigners that I knew, but absolutely Chinese use them as well, because I have a lot of Chinese friends that use Facebook and Twitter, and so they're getting on it through VPNs. What I learned about the Great Firewall, as they call it, is that basically, you know, anybody can get around it if you try hard enough. But the main motivation is that they want to make it as inconvenient as possible for people to try to access the sites that they want blocked. And, you know, largely that works. Like, I would argue that very, very few Chinese actually, you know, have a VPN in order to get Facebook and Twitter. So, I mean, in that respect, you know, it is a successful sort of campaign to block the internet. But then, you know, Chinese are finding other ways to spread information that are outside of Facebook and Twitter.
So you're a young guy, you're single, you go over there, you've just broken up. So dating is part of your life. What did you have to learn about the way dating is practiced? You dated some other foreigners as well, but you also dated Chinese women and had to sort of learn the different definitions of that in Chinese culture.
Yeah, I went out with a few Chinese girls, and it was totally different. In the West, you know, from when you're a teenager, you kind of date people, and you'll have several different boyfriends and girlfriends over the years. But in China, it doesn't really work that way. A lot of people kind of dive headfirst into relationships. They might only have one boyfriend their whole lives. So it was a little bit tricky kind of navigating that, because if you went out for a coffee with somebody, you might think that it's just fairly casual and you're kind of easing yourself into something. But it might kind of blow up. Like, in a couple of incidents, it sort of blew up in my face, where I was on one page and the woman next to me was on a totally different page. And I had to sort of navigate the sensitivities of romance over there.
Speaking of navigating the sensitivities of romance, you made yourself available to be on a Chinese dating game show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this was towards the end of my stay, and I had been kind of pursuing different acting jobs in an attempt to get a taste of marginal fame. In China, a lot of foreigners go over there and they just kind of stumble backwards into being sort of semi-famous. And the most famous case of this is a Canadian man whose Chinese name is Dashan, which means big mountain. And he went there, I think, in the late 80s. And his Chinese is amazing. And he quickly became a sort of stage presence doing these comedy routines. Mm-hmm. And before long, he was just crazy famous. Like, he's probably one of the most famous people in the world that nobody over here has heard of. The first thing you hear from any Chinese person once you speak Chinese is that your Chinese is good, but it's not as good as Dashan's.
Hmm.
So anyway, it was kind of one of these funny little things about the kind of foreigner experience in China that I wanted to explore. So I had been kind of chasing down different acting opportunities. And a friend of mine, who's an American Chinese guy, his uncle was a producer on this dating show, and he called me one day out of the blue and asked if I'd be interested in giving it a shot. And I reluctantly agreed, but it turned out to be a pretty funny experience.
I was amazed that, when you met your fellow, like, bachelor contestants, you guys were talking about why you were there, and they looked at you like you were insane, and they were like, well, we're trying to meet wives. Like, wives.
Yeah, exactly. I was, I was going just for the story. I wanted to have a good story to tell friends, and even if, I didn't end up getting chosen by one of the contestants, I wasn't really thinking about pursuing it. But these other guys on the show were dead serious about finding wives. Like, it was no joke for them. They were super, super excited to be there, and in some cases extremely nervous, because this was their big shot to find love on TV.
So when your one-year tenure at China Daily ended, you did some contract work for the CBC, which was in town to cover the Olympics. And there you had an experience where you realized you actually did have sort of a grasp on Chinese culture and what mattered to the Chinese that your new colleagues did not.
Yeah. During the 2008 Olympics, there was a Chinese hurdler named Liu Xiang, and he had won the gold medal 4 years before that and broken the world record, and he was a demigod in China. People were absolutely crazy about him. They had done a survey before the Olympics where they asked people, what they wanted out of these Olympics, and having Liu Xiang win his second gold was by far and away the most, the most prominent thing that they wanted, on top of even hosting a successful Olympics. So on the day, he had been injured all of that year, and there was this kind of underlying story that he may not even be able to run. And on the day of his first heat, I was at the studio at the CBC, and they were covering triathlon. And my friend texted me saying, did you hear Liu Xiang was out? And I went online and quickly, found out that he had pulled out of his race because of an injury. And I couldn't believe that we had missed this. Like, this was, after spending a year and a half in China, this was just such a huge story. Like, people were going to be absolutely crushed. And in fact, at the event, journalists were, sobbing when they saw that he had pulled out.
Hmm.
So this whole, the whole country was devastated. And meanwhile, we were covering the triathlon. And so I became very vocal about how we should be switching to the hurdles race. And eventually, a guy called me over and told me I better settle down and shut up because people were getting a little bit angry at me. So I sort of learned then that, you know, I'd definitely become a little bit Chinese over the course of time there, because I, you know, thought for sure we should be covering this. But, you know, to my colleagues, it just was a non-story.
Well, I thought that account has really stuck with me since reading the book. And I think it's because, you know, I like to consider myself a reasonably well-informed person. But at some point, you have to recognize that if you're counting on people coming from your country and going elsewhere and trying their level best to understand, there may be a lot that we're missing, a lot of nuance, a lot of little stories that might give us a clearer picture of things overseas.
Yeah, definitely. And this is a challenge for foreign journalists working there, because on the one hand, you know, you can't just be pitching the same stories that you see in the New York Times every day. You know, I can't pitch an editor. I was a freelancer, so later on when I was working freelance, I couldn't just pitch a story about, you know, how China's skies are polluted. But at the same time, if you go too obscure to a story that's only relevant really to somebody who's living there, then editors back home are just, you know, they're just going to pass it over. So it was a bit of a trick trying to find out what was going to appeal to a Western audience, and was, you know, interesting to me to write about as well.
Yeah, because of course when you're freelancing, you have to sort of, am I right, you collect the whole thing, and then after you turn your article in, then you get paid.
Yeah, I mean, it varies. Sometimes I would go ahead and do the whole reporting first if I was confident enough that it would sell as a story later on. Other times I would, you know, write a pitch, do some research online, write a pitch, and then try to sell it that way.
My guest is journalist Mitch Moxley. He writes for publications including The Globe and Mail, The Atlantic, and The New York Times. He has a new memoir out as well. It's called Apologies to My Censor, The High and Low Adventures of a Foreigner in China. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can join us over the phone at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to personal finance. Fall registration opens on August 6th. Catalogs can be requested at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with journalist Mitch Moxley, whose new book is called Apologies to My Censor, The High and Low Adventures of a Foreigner in China. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So you did, you know, you remained in China longer than you had expected. You began working on really serious stories. How did you discover the situation with human trafficking and prostitution that led to a really in-depth report?
Right. So that story, in Beijing, there are a number of different bars that are frequented by Mongolian prostitutes. And I was just kind of curious as to why. Like, why would these Mongolian women be coming to Beijing in order to work in that trade? And I sort of, me and a friend, another journalist, we started looking into it online, and we found a couple reports about human trafficking from Mongolia to China, and we found that it was actually a pretty significant problem. There were several thousand people that were trafficked each year into China, and Mongolia only has a population of a few million, so they're not insignificant numbers. And we did a couple interviews with NGOs working in Ulaanbaatar, and which is the capital of Mongolia. And we just felt that it was a really strong story that really should be told. And so we decided to pursue it as a feature.
And did you ever have reason to worry that the lack of freedom of the press would get in the way and that you would somehow be stopped from reporting what you found?
No, I mean, for that story, we went to the Mongolian border, to a town called Erlian, which is sort of famous as a prostitution hub. And we went to the area where they had a lot of brothels, and we went in and out and interviewed several Mongolian women who had been trafficked. And we didn't have any problems. Like, we didn't have any problems with police or government people stopping us. And that actually was the case for me throughout the time that I was in China. I covered other sensitive issues as well. And never once did I have a problem, with anybody trying to stop me from doing the reporting, which, definitely even now I'm surprised about it. And I think I was probably fortunate in that I was a freelancer, because if I was working for the New York Times or, a prominent American publication, I would definitely have been on people's radar a lot more.
Mm-hmm.
But I think as a freelancer, we were sort of just able to kind of slip underneath the watch of the government and do our reporting.
How does the visa process work for a freelance journalist in China?
I was there basically the entire time on an F visa, which is a business visa. And these visas sort of cover the whole spectrum of foreigners living in China. There are visas specifically for people who are working for Chinese companies, and then there are obviously tourist visas and a journalist visa as well if you're an accredited journalist. But these F visas are fairly easy to procure in China. I would go to an agent every 6 months, hand over a couple $100, and then a week later I'd have a new visa in my passport. And so, I was able to last 6 years on that, and I'm sure at some stage they're going to close down that system. But there are currently quite a few foreigners living on those type of visas.
And there was one guy who wanted to get you a visa and said, oh, and by the way, import this car for me so I don't have to pay any duties.
That was a nightmare. Before the Olympics, there was a crackdown in China on foreigners and foreigner visas, and which seems a bit counterintuitive considering, it was the Olympics and you'd think that they'd want people from all over the world to be coming to watch it. But it became very, very hard to get a visa at that time, and I had left China Daily, so I didn't have the visa that I was on previous, and I was only on a tourist visa that wasn't going to last through the Olympics. So I was contacting agents online, and they had been really shutting down these kind of gray market agents that were providing visas. And I found a British guy and a Canadian guy, and they were going to give me a one-year residence visa for $1,000. And I handed over the money and my passport, and I was very nervous about this already. And then they called me into a meeting and asked if I would sign my name to this car that they were going to import from China or from Hong Kong, because foreigners were able to import cars tax-free, but Chinese weren't. So they wanted to bring this car in from Hong Kong for a Chinese citizen so that they wouldn't have to pay tax. But I decided that I was kind of nervous enough already, and I didn't want to get the boot, so I told them I wasn't going to do it, and they thankfully gave my money back.
Were you surprised that the Olympics, after a very short time, just felt like a whip and not fun and exciting at all?
I think no matter what, what position you're in, if you're living in a city that's hosting the Olympics, there's so much excitement in the lead up to it that it's inevitably going to seem like a bit of a letdown, because it's only 16 days and it comes and goes so quickly. For me, because I was working very, very long hours, I was starting at 4 in the morning and having to commute across the city to get from work, and I felt like I was sort of missing out on the Olympics experience. I had friends in town that I was barely able to see because I was working so hard. So definitely, when the Olympics hit about halfway through, I definitely felt that sort of, I wouldn't say depression, but I was a little bit kind of disappointed that they were here and they were going so fast. And then, I didn't know what was going to happen to me or the city after the Olympics went.
You are not the first author I've read that described living in Beijing as, the energy becomes almost addictive. Can you talk about what it was about life there in that city that you found so appealing?
It is definitely an addictive place to live. I think part of it is that change is happening so quickly there, and you notice it on a day-to-day level at street level. Like the alley that I lived in, from one week to the next would be transformed. There'd be a new bar, a new cafe, or something like that. And so witnessing that type of change is a very incredible feeling, and it's an incredible feeling being a part of that. And the other thing is that, the world's just paying so much attention to China So, you open the New York Times, there's always a story about China. As a freelancer, I was able to sort of work my way up to write for these publications that I'd always dreamed of writing. And I mean, I just don't know if that would have happened in another place. And then, the type of people that are drawn there as foreigners, you meet a lot of really, really interesting people from all over the world. And everybody's sort of there for the same reasons. So everybody's kind of always up for doing something. There's sort of adventure around every corner. And yeah, I mean, it's a bit of a drug, you get a bit hooked on it. I definitely did.
Was your circle of friends a pretty transient population? People who came and stayed for a while and then intended to go back from to wherever they came?
Yeah, absolutely. And while that is one of the best things about living in a place like Beijing, where you're meeting all these incredible people all the time, one of the hardest things is that you're constantly having to reinvent your friend group. I eventually found people that were staying there sort of for the medium term, like 4 or 5, 6 years. But that doesn't make it easy. I found that every couple of years there'd be like a real transition where some really key people would leave and be replaced by people who are getting a lot younger than I was, and it makes it really hard. It's definitely an up and down life being a foreigner in China, and I think that was a big part of it.
So there's really no way around it that as a guy of European descent, you sort of wear your foreignness on your face in a place like China. Did you feel the need to, be a upstanding representative of Canadian culture, or I mean, how did you feel about that and about the fact that instantly people could recognize just by looking at you that there was something different about you?
Yeah, I mean, it is a bit strange always standing out, and you definitely don't want to give your country a bad reputation. But the flip side of that is that because you are different, you feel like you can kind of do whatever you want, and that sort of brings us back to these guys that stay there for so long. I think that's one of the reasons that they do is because they have totally reinvented themselves and are able to do whatever it is that they please. And I mean, that's one of the more addictive things about living there.
You describe it almost like Neverland, Peter Pan's Neverland.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it is one of these places that sucks you in, and you can reinvent yourself, and you never really have to grow up. And absolutely, these guys at China Daily who are in their 50s and 60s, I mean, they haven't grown up in the sort of same, in the sense, the Western sense. Like they don't have wives, they don't have children. They lead a life with very few responsibilities, and I mean, I was sort of worried that was going to happen to me as well. I was at the point where I'd been there for 6 years by the time I left, and I was sort of at the point where I was going to have to decide if I'm going to make this my home or if I want to kind of come back to North America and give it a try there. But yeah, I mean, the Neverland thing, so many people talk about it. I wasn't the one that came up with this idea of the Neverland over there. And definitely people can sort of relate to that experience of being sucked into a place and not wanting to leave.
How did you decide it was time to go?
I felt, getting the book deal and writing the book was like a really, it was a good point, I thought, to leave. 6 years is just a long time. And the year before I left, I had one of these times where I was talking about where a lot of friends had left. And, all around me, it felt like my friends were moving on to other places, or they had, settled down into relationships. And it just, it kind of scared me a bit. I didn't want to be stuck in China. I didn't want to wake up and be, 45, 50 years old, still kind of doing what I was doing in Beijing. And it became really clear to me about a year before I actually left that it was time to go. And so I started putting things in motion to make that happen.
Are you back living in Toronto now?
No, I'm currently in New York.
Okay. So what did you notice about Western culture when you moved back for good? And I know that New York and Toronto are very different cities. But were there things that you picked up on that had just never occurred to you before about the way things are done in this part of the world that you were sensitive to because of having lived in China?
Well, I mean, the thing that stands out, there's a couple things that stand out most. One is that in Beijing, I lived in the center of the city, in this historic kind of alleyway district, and all of my friends lived in this area, and I kind of knew it, I knew it all. I knew where, all the great bars were, all the great cafes were, all the good restaurants were. And everywhere that I'd go, I'd always see people that I knew, and it was incredibly comforting. And then you come to a place like New York, and, you're just totally anonymous. And so that, I mean, that aspect of the transition really stands out. And the other thing is just how convenient it is here. You know, if you want to go to a movie, you just go to the theater and, you know, there's a ton of movies to choose from. You know, all these things, all these little conveniences that I didn't really have over there. I know these aren't really, you know, cultural differences, but these are the things that really stand out about moving here.
You know, what's great about that is that to have lived in a place that is less convenient as a young person, you'll always sort of appreciate what's easy now, right?
Yeah, definitely. I was at my friend's place the other day. I was just flipping through an issue of The New Yorker, and I was just thinking, oh, this is so great. I can actually subscribe to magazines again, have them delivered to my home instead of having my parents mail some out every couple of weeks.
Tell us about the your inclusion in Chinese Vogue.
Oh, yeah. So I was one of China's 100 hottest bachelors in 2009, and the editors had actually never seen me before. A friend of mine used to work with one of the editors there, and she was getting desperate to fill up the pages, and so she gave him a call one afternoon, and we went over a couple days later to the Cosmo. It was actually Chinese Cosmo.
Chinese Cosmo, excuse me. Yeah,
yeah, and we went over to the offices, and they gave us suits to wear, and the only suit that fit me was just this awful double-breasted kind of patterned suit that was just terrible. And anyway, they took a bunch of pictures, and a couple months later, I was flipping through the Valentine's issue of Cosmo, and lo and behold, there I was, and I sort of looked like a vampire. They had taken all the color out of my face, and my hair looked jet black, and I was wearing this awful suit. It was not the finest photo I've ever seen.
And then you and this buddy of yours that was also featured decided to have a contest to see how much response that you received from this kind of amazing publicity in a country of a billion people.
Yeah. So we had to include our email addresses in our little bios. And we thought that we would just be getting flood, you know, streams of emails, thousands maybe. And that didn't happen. We were in the few dozens, and I think I edged him out by a few emails. But and we made a bet over dinner, but he never actually bought me the dinner. So it's his wedding in a couple weeks, so I'm going to call him on that.
Did it help you in your dating life? Were you able to sort of mention this to young women that you had been featured?
No, I didn't go on a date with anybody who contacted me, but it makes a good story on dates now, so maybe it'll help out in the future.
Yeah. Is there anything about the memoir that has changed you as a writer, the process of writing about your own life that is different from what you were doing before?
So the book, I think, when you read it, it's a lot more personal than I think a lot of people expect, and the original drafts weren't as personal. They were a little bit more kind of journalistic, and mm-hmm. My agent and editor reminded me that I was the main character of the book, and so I needed to be in it throughout, and readers needed to be able to follow sort of my emotional development. So that was difficult to do, and it's even difficult, you know, now knowing that it's out there, and it is a very, you know, personal book, and a lot of, you know, people who read it know these things about me that I'm not entirely comfortable about sharing, but I think were sort of necessary to drive the plot along. So, that was a big kind of departure from, the previous journalism that I've been doing.
Mitch Moxley's new book is called Apologies to My Censor, The High and Low Adventures of a Foreigner in China. Mitch, fascinating stories. Thank you so much for being with us this hour.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy, with the podcast produced by Christine McConnell. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer, and Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can download the podcast free at kera.org/think. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.